Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 6th of December. Monday, it's 9, all things political, as it always is, and today our guest is Professor Lawrence Jacobs. He is director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota. He has put together some absolutely marvelous symposiums on various topics, and he has written extensively The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America, and The Search for Community. There's a good conversation sometime down the road for an hour. Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream, The Private Abuse of the Public Interest, and much more. And he has appeared on our show frequently. We do want to tell you, just because Walter Mondale's name comes to mind when we think of Lawrence, that Walter Mondale will be our guest on Thursday of this week. And the second hour of the program, a very interesting project that's underway right now. There are a number of American presidents who have secretly taped conversations, and our guest the second hour of the program will be looking and will be listening to some conversations that President Kennedy and President Johnson had, primarily on foreign policy, but will branch into some other areas as well. Our guest, Assistant Director for Presidential Studies and Associate Professor with the Presidential Recordings Program at the University of Virginia, and he is coordinating the work of the Presidential Recordings Program and the Presidential Oral History Program. Some very interesting tape that will be hearing, and that's coming up hour number two. Both hours, you are welcome to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We'll start our conversation with what you heard on the news just a few moments ago, that it looks as though a compromise has been reached to extend all Bush-era tax cuts in exchange for giving people more unemployment benefits, because so many people are unemployed. There is a lot of controversy about this issue. There are a lot of people who are mad at the president about this. And we'll start our first hour conversation with this conversation with Professor Lawrence Jacobs. Professor Jacobs, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Well, the news said that it looks, and I guess this would, it was inevitable from conversation over the last couple of days, that the Bush-era tax cuts will be extended. The president's base is going to be very upset about this. A number of people have written about it in the last couple weeks. Tell me what you think of this, if this compromise was necessary. And question number two would be, have the tax cuts for the very wealthy among us helped the economy during the past 10 years?
Well, these are topics, obviously, some of them real controversy. But first, let's cut to the facts. There was going to be no extension of unemployment insurance. There was going to be no extension of the middle-class tax cuts have been in place for some time, and that President Obama expanded on, unless there was a deal. There was a vote on what the Democrats preferred, and it was defeated. There were, a handful of Democrats in the Senate who voted against it, along with every Republican. So it was there's not much ambiguity. There was either going to be a compromise or there was going to be nothing. And that's frustrating for folks, at least for some folks, but that is just the reality. In terms of the tax cuts and their impact, they did have an impact, but as the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office showed in a report not long ago, it didn't have as much of an impact that other kinds of spending might have had.
So the reason that the Republicans have, and some Democrats voted with them, to extend for the very wealthy is what? A belief among Americans that we're all going to reach that bracket sometime, or that eventually it will really stimulate the economy?
Well, I think, a variety of people hold some of those views, and I think that's part of the challenge on tax reform. But I think there is a very broad consensus in Washington, including a good number of Democrats, that we are in a very precarious economic situation right now. We're kind of on the cusp where we have a slow recovery, but it could easily slip back into a double-dip recession. And this is not the time to raise any taxes. And so the thinking of President Obama and other Democrats is We would rather not see the taxes, tax cuts for the those earning families $250,000 more a year go up. But this is probably not a good time to be having their taxes go up when we need people to feel as if they can spend money and can make investments.
What about, I believe it was Schumer's proposal that we put it up at $1 million?
That didn't get any traction in Congress. It's a nice soundbite. I think Senator Schumer takes pride in his ability to kind of package things. But that had the same outcome in terms of votes in the Senate as President Obama's proposal that he ran on back in 2008.
And the president has, would you say, changed his mind on this issue? Wasn't he for, and I don't know how deeply he was for tax cuts for the middle class, but not for the wealthy. He seems to have not had a strong opinion on this.
Well, I think he had a strong opinion, but the reality of our government is that no one gets to control things. We have, as we all know from our intro to American politics as kids, and hopefully in college, that the president has his views, but Congress has its set of powers. President put forward his proposal. It was passed in the House. We just need a majority. But in the Senate, where the Democrats are in the majority, but you need 60 votes to overcome a filibuster, the Democrats are one vote short of the filibuster. So they have 59 when you include the independents. But they also found that some of the Democrats in their caucus were more moderate or conservative, did not support the president's plan. So the president put up his plan. It was defeated.
Right. And what about the deficit, Senator Jacobs? There have been, Senator, are you going to run for office, Professor Jacobs? What about the deficit? There's been a whole lot of talk. We got to get it down. Do you see a disconnect between this tax policy and reducing the deficit?
Well, you know, I think you just look at it in the logic. On the one hand, we're saying we've got to cut spending, and I think most people agree with that. But if we were to extend the all of the tax cuts from 2001 and 2003, the cost over 10 years would be about $4 trillion. So, you know, there is a bit of a disconnect between let's bring down the deficit, but let's also cut taxes now. Now we get into the kind of gray areas because there's a strong belief among some economists, but not all, that cutting taxes does generate some revenue and would help to generate private sector job growth. But I would say independent analyses of that are very mixed, and probably the balance of opinion is that we're not getting the same growth as was projected. Now, I think everybody agrees that we need to get the deficit in the long term under control. About 60% of our gross domestic product is now devoted to deficit spending. And we don't want to be in that position. We certainly don't want it to grow. But the question is, when do we address that deficit? And I think the thinking among responsible economists and policymakers is when you're in a recession or just coming out of one, particularly one as steep as the one we've been in for the last couple of years, this is not the time to be cutting back and spending or raising taxes.
Let's look at the unemployment rate and this tax policy hand-in-hand with an extension of unemployment benefits. What was the reasoning behind not extending benefits to those people who have been out of work for a long period of time?
Well, this was a concern among Republicans that we were going to be kind of adding to the deficit. But as part of this compromise that appears to be now emerging in Washington, the president and some Democrats are going to sign on to extending the tax cuts from 2001 and 2003 to the upper income groups. And in exchange, the Republicans are going to sign on to extending the unemployment benefits. The sticking point, and I'm not sure it's been fully resolved at this point, is will the cost for the extension of unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed be something that's funded out of the deficit, or will there have to be commensurate cuts in other parts of government? There appears to be some support among Republicans that we ought to be able to accept this as deficit spending and that we shouldn't be looking for, for commensurate cuts in government spending.
Was this just sort of symbolic on the part of the president, pay freeze for federal employees? I read a figure, I don't know how accurate this is, that the average salary would be $75,000. Was this a concession to the Republicans? What was the president doing with this?
Well, this is one of the areas where Democrats have been furious at the president. Paul Krugman has been just blasting Obama for a tendency to negotiate with himself and to make these ineffective gestures. And this is, I would say, kind of one of the exhibits that's brought forward for Obama's lack of political skill in handling this period. It appears, and we don't know, but it appears that the White House was thinking this would signal that the president was serious about deficit reduction. On the other hand, there are quite a number of folks who've come out and say, well, it's true that the federal employees on average are earning more than private sector employees, but if you look at the training of federal employees with, you know, the doctor's degrees or the PhDs and other degrees, they're actually under what you would see in the private sector, again, in terms of level of training. There are a lot of Democrats who are furious at Obama for doing this. He got nothing in exchange for it except some derision from some of the Republicans.
And what about that criticism that he just tries to extend an olive branch over and over? Those who are of the progressive bend say that what he needs to do is be a very strong leader and skip the olive branch. It hasn't worked for him in the past.
Well, I mean, if you think about Ronald Reagan, who I think most people would say was a masterful bargainer, Ronald Reagan would stake out a position. He would make it very clear, and he would leave no doubt that he was not going to compromise on it. And he would stick with it very, very long into negotiations, to the point where a lot of people would start to wonder if they were really at a deadlock. And then at the very last minute, when he had extracted the most concessions from his opponents, he too would then make a compromise. And I think the feeling with a good number of Democrats and some independent observers is that Barack Obama just lacks the nerve to engage in this kind of negotiations where it's a little bit of a chicken, where you're really willing to signal at least you're going to go up to the edge of a deadlock, perhaps even a government shutdown, without kind of caving. And whether it's on this or a whole number of other issues before the midterm elections, the sense is that, again, among progressives, that Obama caves, doesn't have the backbone.
I think it was Senator Harkin who said just a couple of days ago that if the president allowed the Bush-era tax cuts to continue for the wealthy, he can say goodbye to the presidency in 2012.
I think it's a little premature. We've got a long way to go before 2012. The president's trying to represent the country. I think most people would say we needed something done on the tax cuts. It's falling far, far short of what progressives would like and liberals. But on the other hand, his job is not to represent the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, to the great disgruntlement of the progressives, but rather to try to bring people together. He's got to build the coalitions. And if you're going to do that in our divided form of government, particularly now that the Democrats do not have the control of Congress, then he's going to have to compromise, which means he's going to have to accept things that he would prefer not to accept.
And before we go to phone calls, Professor Jacobs, what about this unemployment rate? We're at almost 10% now. Obviously, that's the issue that the American people want the government to tackle. What can be done?
Well, you know, I think this is one of those areas that we have to do something about. And I think there's a huge disconnect between Washington. We're hearing a lot of discussion about long-term deficits and almost no discussion of what is now long-term unemployment. We now have a record number of Americans who are able-bodied, want to work, and have been unable to find work for a long, sustained period of time. You've got to go back really to the 1940s and 30s. To find a similar level of long-term unemployment. And I think Americans have every right to be frustrated with both parties. They're not really bringing forward concrete ideas on this. And again, the focus on the deficit. In the long term, you have to do that. But in the short term, we need a lot more concrete, pragmatic, and effective ideas for how to get jobs going again.
We go to phone calls for Professor Lawrence Jacobs in just one moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 6th of December. He's professor and director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Mark Silverstone, Assistant Director for Presidential Studies and Associate Professor with the Presidential Recordings Program at the University of Virginia. He has been working on the tapes that have been released, the conversations that Presidents Johnson and Kennedy had with various important officials. We'll be hearing some of those tapes and talking with him about the Presidential Recordings Program, which he is coordinating. All right, let's go to phone calls for Professor Lawrence Jacobs, starting with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I wrote a little reflection on the passiveness of the American public and religious community, too, in facing the wasteful war, which wars which contribute to the debt. And I want to dedicate it to the young people considering military service, and it's called American Schemes, and I'll say it slowly. Well, I ain't no fool, and I ain't no foil, and I ain't going to war for big oil. Don't play me, because I ain't no sucker risking my butt for the rich money plucker. No money left for the yous and me's down some rat hole overseas. When will the fools ever learn? No money, no lives left to burn. Most of our efforts are in vain. On the world we haul a train. Some say accept it, got no choice. Was Pontius Pilate a prophetic voice?
Professor Jacobs.
Well, I understand Jim's sentiment, and but I think it needs to be said that the war in Afghanistan is not one of those wars that there's been a lot of disagreement in terms of the need to go into it. This was one of the areas that Barack Obama was very, very clear about during the election, that this was a neglected war, this was a platform for attacks on America on 9/11, and we had to engage. There has been, I think, a fairly wide agreement across party lines that the Afghan-Pakistan region does present a real threat to America. I think Jim's sentiment is really directed probably to Iraq. And that's a situation where President Obama has, really reduced the troop levels from well over 100,000 to about 50,000 now. And, we can see, if you follow it closely, and that's kind of moved off the front headlines, there's been quite a bit of, violence and maybe a simmering civil war in Iraq, but that is not going to pull us back in. So I think there's been an effort by this administration to pull back from Iraq, which was the source of controversy, while making a very substantial increase in troops and resources in Afghanistan and in different forms in Pakistan.
And do you think that we've made any progress in Afghanistan, Professor Jacobs?
We haven't talked about the Wikipedia leaks, but, if you read those cables, it's hard not to be dispirited.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is, we got cables in there to talk about President Karzai's brother and top aides, walking around with suitcases with tens of millions of dollars in them. And, it's a corrupt regime. And it's very ineffective in terms of its relations with other parts of Afghanistan, between the central government and the regional government. And there's, I think, within the military, if you listen carefully, you can hear a lot of skepticism about progress and how well this is going. I think the president, and this also comes through the cables, which are interesting reading, has really tried to put increasing pressure on Karzai to take seriously his responsibility to create an Afghan army that can protect the central government. And part of that date that President Obama set of July 2011 to start pulling back troops was intended and maybe having some effect in bringing home the reality that there will be a day at which America and our NATO allies pull out.
It's been going on a long time.
It has. I think it's, I share the frustration about that. And I think, frankly, the country's attention wasn't fully engaged in Afghanistan. You remember back to the heated discussions about whether enough troops were sent in, whether there was an understanding of the realities on the ground in Afghanistan. And so we've made some real mistakes. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And we're now, I think, at least have a plan of training Afghan troops. One of the things that we realized is that the pay for the Afghan troops was far less than what the Taliban were paying. So now we've rectified that, and we appear to be making a bit more progress. But it's a mixed bag. I mean, it's hard to feel enthusiastic or confident that this is going to work out in a better way.
Jim, thank you for your contribution. 800-486-8655 is our number. It's All Things Political. And we go to Mike from South Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. Merry Christmas ahead of time.
Thanks. See you, too.
As a liberal, not a progressive, Barack Obama is a failure. He's a lame duck. He's a disaster. And it's just a matter of time before Democrats start calling him not to run for the presidency. He's in charge of the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of this country. That's my comment. My question, what does the guest think about the impending state and municipal bond crisis? The headline in the New York Times yesterday, Moody's and the other rating agencies are giving states bond ratings AAA, just like they did securitized mortgage things. This is the next disaster that's coming. My final comment to all Wisconsinites, go Christmas shopping at Walmart and fill your tree with gifts made in China to boost our economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Professor Jacobs.
Well, sometimes we get so wrapped up in the heat of the moment, I fear that we kind of lose the big picture. There's a lot of frustration, obviously, with Barack Obama. I think that's going to grow. But, again, the reality of our form of government is he is not in charge. He's got the executive branch, and he makes proposals. But even when the Democrats had control of the House and the Senate, they had the 60-vote margin, his proposals were repeatedly defeated. Now, it's hard to think of, why you would hold him responsible for that. Plus, you kind of look on the other side of the ledger, and I would recommend listening and reading what the conservatives are saying. And what they see is a socialist in the White House. I think that's overstated. But this is a president who's passed the most liberal health reform we've seen ever in this country. It's a very substantial redistribution of resources from the affluent healthcare providers and equipment suppliers to the upper middle class and on down in terms of health insurance and health care. It's hard to see why that wouldn't be considered a monumental liberal accomplishment. But again, I think at the moment there's a lot of anger, there's disappointment. We've got political parties, and I think a good number of Americans who are very polarized, but our government is not conducive to kind of party government the way you would see, let's say, in Britain.
Well, part of the problem, don't you think, is we're having some kind of fire alarm here. It's kind of weird. We got lights going on. Part of the problem is this huge gap. I don't want to concentrate on this completely, but I don't fully understand this. Between those who have and those who don't have, we bailed out Wall Street. They were doing some pretty crooked deals to make a lot of money. And Now they're giving themselves these incredibly huge bonuses for putting us in, for doing criminal kinds of behavior, and they're making profits off it. In the meantime, we've got an unemployment rate of 10%, and we continue to reward the people who weren't doing very good things for the economy or for the American people. I have a hard time understanding why more people aren't very upset about this, and actually why the president hasn't taken some of these people to task.
Well, I think you've just described why the Democrats took a shellacking, as the president put it,
right,
in November, because they did get blamed for bailing out Wall Street. And the sense of there was a lot of money that went to Wall Street, and a lot of money has been spent in a stimulus package, but people cannot see the results. And I think the president does have a legitimate argument that there were at least several million jobs that were saved or created, and that things would be much worse without the stimulus. But it's a very difficult argument to make to people who are unemployed or worried about losing their jobs. The situation with the bankers, that's probably a situation where the president would handle it differently today. There were points where he called them on the carpet. But remember, we have a private market system here, and the president is dependent on businesses taking that $1 trillion they're sitting on right now and investing it in jobs. So if the president comes out and lambasts bankers and businesses, he's likely to contribute to the problem of slow or sluggish economic growth. And I think that helps to explain why he's not been as forceful or strident in attacking some of these businesses, particularly in Wall Street, that
have right.
been outrageous in their behavior, and as frustrating as that is, we can't really operate without them.
Mike, thank you very much for your call. Let us go now to Patrick from Madison. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I'd like to sort of take issue with the professor on some of his characterizations of Barack Obama's support for tax cuts for the super wealthy. I consider myself a yellow dog Democrat. I'd vote for a yellow dog before I'd vote for a Republican. But I also took time off of work to go door-to-door around the state here in Wisconsin to support Barack Obama. But I will not support him in 2012, and I'm going to actively work for any other candidate that looks better than him. I think it's really an issue of having a backbone. And, you know, you've said that it's the heat of the moment, but it really isn't. It's been going on for 2 years now. He doesn't stand up against the Republicans. On this issue, he could win. He could win this issue, and instead he's caving in. He's caving in to the wealthy, and he's not losing progressives and liberals. He's losing Democrats. It's not. If you poll this issue, the vast majority of Democrats support standing the line, even if it means increases temporarily for middle-class taxes. I would be happy to pay more taxes to stand up against the Republicans, but every single time, from health care on down the line, he has caved. We need someone new. If he wants to step down and let Biden take a chance at it, let's do that. But we need someone in there that's going to fight for us.
Professor Jacobs.
Well, again, it's frustrating for Patrick and others, but there was a vote on the president's tax proposal. It was defeated. It did not get 60 votes. There were about 7 votes short. Now, unless Patrick knows a different form of government in America, which I don't, there is no way around that. Now, could the president have, done a whistle-stop tour around the country? Yeah. But the reality is he wasn't going to get 60 even if he kind of brought the government to a standstill.
Let them expire.
Well, I mean, then you get into the concern of, I think, almost every economist who's kind of reasonable, that increasing taxes.
Let them expire and let the Republicans take the heat for letting them expire.
Yeah, and I don't
Obama
think
can put up another middle-class tax cut proposal in January and say, if you want these cuts, we'll let them go through. I'm going to veto anything for anything over $250,000. And he wins that fight politically. But he's unwilling to fight. We need a fighter.
I think he could take that rhetorical position. But come January, the odds of getting these bills passed, even what he's getting now, goes down. Looked at from the position of Republicans who are taking some heat today for agreeing to expand the unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed, they're caving in too. And there are a lot of Republicans, and particularly Tea Party conservatives, who are saying, why not wait? We're going to have a much better position come, you know, early January than right now.
But what are they taking heat for? I'm sorry, that's just the humanly decent thing to do, to make sure that people are able, they can't find jobs. This isn't a made-up situation. How are they supposed to live? That's just, it's not even partisan, I don't think.
Well, what you hear from a good number of Republicans is, fine, let's extend long-term unemployment benefits, but rather than adding to an already bloated deficit, and again, I'm using the language of Republicans, let's make commensurate cuts in other areas of government spending. That has been a sticking point. And the concern, again, and I think it's fairly broad sector of economists is, and others, that cutting government spending at a time when we need that stimulus, or when you're seeing, you know, a variety of businesses and individuals really suffering, doesn't make sense either.
So in other words, it's a big old mess, huh?
Well, we've got some very different views. And if you kind of look around Europe, you're going to see quite a range of different approaches. I don't
right.
think there's a kind of a magic wand on how we get out of this. There are different ideas. We have in Minnesota a former member of Congress who just got defeated, Jim Oberstar, been in Congress for over 35 years. And his proposal back in early 2009 was, let's not do the tax cuts. Let's instead take that money and put it into a massive public works program to rebuild our infrastructure. And, you know, that really didn't get much traction. There are a lot of folks who think that's an idea to go back to, because you would put a lot of people to work, and it would be in areas where we need a lot of updating.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Patrick, for your call. Bob in Janesville, hi.
Yes, the big lie here to start out with is that unemployment is only 10%. Unemployment is as high as 90% in some places in this country. And the administration, the people, the talking heads are...
Oh, he's gone. I don't know what happened to him.
But I agree. I actually agree with Bob. I mean, I think it is shameful, this disconnect between Washington, where all we've heard about for the last 2 weeks is deficit reductions and tax cuts. And the question that, you know, you just look at the polls that really vast numbers of Americans have is, what are we going to do about the situation of high unemployment?
Right.
And particularly high long-term unemployment. I mean, this is a crisis, because it not only puts families in jeopardy of just paying for the basic necessities of life, but we know that it has all sorts of cascading effects in terms of the, you know, how families operate, a sense of self-worth,
of course,
and how our communities are going to shape up. This is a crisis.
Let's go to Pat from Brookfield. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. A couple comments and then a question. It's always interesting to me that the Democratic Party, they seem to find themselves in this quandary where they depend on about 20% of the population, you know, and the first few callers illustrated that, to go door-to-door, make phone calls, you know, support the candidacy. But then when they find out, you know, you have to govern for the 75% of the country that does not hold those views, it's like the liberals, they don't understand it's a democracy. And I would just point to Bill Clinton. He moved completely to the center. He did welfare reform. He got elected resoundingly, and he's a very popular president now. So being kind of a moderate Republican myself, I don't know, I guess go live in Copenhagen, Denmark if you want. But my question, secondly, would be on unemployment benefits. Does there come to a point in time where extending these unemployment benefits becomes just another permanent entitlement program? And finally, I would just add that I understand a lot of people are out of work, but there's also a lot of stories. Bucyrus just had one the other day where they can't find welders. And, you know, my suggestion would be, for some of these people, the days of standing on an assembly line you know, pushing buttons for $38 an hour. Those days are gone. You need to go back, get some training. This is the new economy, and it's tough to deal with, but at some point you just can't keep extending unemployment benefits forever.
Pat, have you ever lost a job? Pat? Well, Pat's, I don't know, where is everybody today? I think that we're looking at numbers now, and I have read that you've got five people looking for every one job, and for some industries, I think he's right, they're no longer in existence. They've been shipped overseas, but we haven't figured out, our economy hasn't figured out how to absorb all of those people. And I don't think it's the people's fault here. I think we're muddling through a changing economy, and we haven't found our way.
And what we know is that the kind of economic crisis that we're coming out of is the worst kind to recover from. In other words, sometimes you head into a recession that's driven by the fact there's kind of a dip in demand, and then we've got good tools to get that demand up so consumers go back to the stores. But we're coming out of a crisis that is about finance and credit. And it's very hard to kind of rebuild, you know, the financial system. And, you know, we can see just the reverberations, whether it's in mortgages, where you have just an astounding number of households that are near or in, you know, a situation where they owe more than they have in equity. Or we see it in the States, as referred to earlier, where they're now in a very precarious situation in terms of just keeping up on payments on their bonds, or what we're seeing with unemployment and the very great difficulty in getting the job production back going. And this is based on having studied lots of countries and different times over time in terms of the consequences of financial crisis. So this is a very different kind of animal we're dealing with right now. It's very, very painful.
Thanks, Pat, for the call. Margaret in Madison. Hello, Margaret.
Hi. I've got a question. I don't know enough about economics to really ask a profound question, but I know Reagan had the theory of trickle-down economy, but war is always a boost to the economy, but it seems to be a trickle-up economy here. Could you tell me who the profiteers are of this Afghanistan war? Where's the money going? Somebody's making a profit on war.
I don't know enough about that to really give an answer I'd be confident in.
What difference would it make to end that war in terms of the economy? We heard for about 2 days that maybe we would see some kind of peace dividend from Iraq. Obviously, that didn't happen. But is this adding to the deficit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the president's been very upfront, to the consternation of the Pentagon, that we cannot afford to be in Iraq and Afghanistan indefinitely. We just don't have the resources to do it. And part of his, you know, somewhat courageous insistence that this July will mark a gradual withdrawal, at least, of troops is premised on we cannot afford this. We need those resources back home.
Thank you, Margaret, for your call. You're listening to All Things Political for this Monday, the 6th of December. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Professor Lawrence Jacobs is our guest, professor and director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Matt Taibbi will be joining us. He is the author, most recently, of Griftopia. He calls these people the network of looters who sit at the nexus of American political and economic power. The truth behind the financial catastrophe is being whitewashed, he says, by this group, consisting of the largest players in the financial industry and the politicians who do their bidding. On Wednesday, David Eisenhower will be with us. He's written about his grandfather in an interesting book. He will be with us Wednesday. And then on Thursday, Walter Mondale will be with us. So some interesting shows ahead. We go back to phone calls. Let's go to Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I guess my point is regarding the tax cut situation is and the big argument is we can't afford $70 billion a year and the $700 billion over 10 years for the upper income tax bracket. So if we can't afford $70 billion, in truth, we can't afford the $2.3 trillion for everyone else.
Professor Jacobs.
Well, you know, I think the thinking here is when you provide a tax cut to the upper income groups, they already have plenty of money. So, and there's a lot of research showing this, they tend to save that money. Whereas if you provide a tax cut for lower income groups, middle and on, well, particularly the middle and upper middle classes, that they're much more apt to spend that money. It's going to provide a stimulus to the economy. In addition, there is obviously an agenda behind those tax cuts beyond the immediate economic malaise we're in, which is to address this very large and probably growing gap between most Americans and that top 10%, or really, frankly, the top 1%, who have done very well, and as we were just talking about, particularly in the finance industry, are continuing to do extraordinarily well.
Thank you, Scott, for your call. Rick in Gays Mills. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. I have a question for your guest. It comes off of an article I read by Jeffrey Rosen in the Sunday New York Times Magazine a couple weeks ago, where he talked about what the Tea Partiers and a whole group of Republicans feel about the Constitution. And they feel there's nothing in the Constitution that allows for the redistribution of wealth in this country, culture, and unemployment benefits, higher taxes on the rich, and the rest that they all view as redistribution of wealth. And they feel as strongly about that as one of your earlier colleagues did about Obama not being liberal or aggressive enough. And so my question is, how widespread is this concept, and then how do you make an argument on the other side of it? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
I appreciate Rick's comment because I actually read, a part of the conservative press and the discussions that are going on. And I think for liberals and progressives who are, had it with Obama, it's worth reading intelligent conservative commentary that view this president as the most liberal president we've ever had. And to be honest, I think there are some areas, not across the board, but there are some areas, and particularly health care reform, where there's been a very substantial, perhaps historic, effort to redirect resources from the higher income groups. Let me just give you two examples in health care reform, where you've got an expansion of Medicare's tax on the upper income groups, and a brand new tax that's been introduced on Medicare that is directed at capital gains. So those wins on Wall Street are now going to be taxed. And that's a big part of the funding for health care reform. Now, the constitutional argument, frankly, we've been having this for about 70 or 80 years, and it goes back to the New Deal. If you kind of look at the course of Supreme Court decisions, there's no doubt that the government does have the authority to tax. This has been reaffirmed again and again and again, and to redistribute resources. How it does it and the kind of tools it uses is an area of dispute, but I would describe that as kind of, one about mechanisms rather than the principle of does the government have the constitutional authority to tax and tax some more than others, and then use those resources for things like Social Security and other programs.
Well, and then you have another question. Let me ask what you think about this. It looks as though we're giving states the authority to pull the plug on people. I'm referencing the Arizona story where the man who needed a liver transplant, and it was all set for him, where the government in Arizona and Jan Brewer said, sorry, we don't have the money. We don't have the Medicaid money. We can't cover this. Isn't that what the Tea Party people were concerned about? It's pulling the plug not on grandma, but on a 36-year-old man.
Yeah. I mean, And again, this is one of those questions about mechanisms. What Arizona did was it faced a deficit in its Medicaid program, which is funded through a formula that, which the federal and the state governments share the cost, but it's administered at the state level, and rather than raising taxes in Arizona or making cuts in other programs to pay for Arizona's Medicaid costs, they have slashed their support for organ transplants in a whole variety of areas, heart, liver, lungs, and others. And it looks like there are about 100 individuals who are at risk of dying from not getting those organ transplants. They also cut their program that provides insurance to about 47,000 children.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I mean, you know, this is, we're going to see some very serious efforts to get spending down and avoid raising taxes. I think Arizona, as in other areas, is going to be kind of a poster board for one set of fiscal decisions.
Well, where is the dialogue on this? I mean, this is a fairly serious situation. If you don't have, if you're on Medicaid, you can't get the best in technology. In other words, we'll just let you die.
Yeah. Oh, I think we're part of that dialogue. I think the story in the New York Times is part of it. There will be more elections in Arizona. Let's see how Arizonans respond to this. You know, this is how things are done in a democracy, and we may well see court cases moving forward. One thing just to note, the healthcare reform is a fairly dramatic effort to reshape how states operate, and its change in Medicaid is one of the largest shifts, and we're going to see a fairly significant expansion in Medicaid with federal matching dollars to pay for that. So that's something else just to keep on the horizon.
Thanks, Rick, for the call. We go to Glenn in Manitowoc. Hi, Glenn.
Good morning, and Professor, very good job of trying to explain things to people. I've been pretty angry ever since Black Tuesday, so forgive me if I get a little flustered here. First off, point number one, I'm real tired of the Obama bashing that's going on. I think he's been doing or attempting to do a really good job. It is in regards to the tax cuts. He was very clear here a couple of months ago about giving corporations and businesses tax cuts that actually create American employment. Two of the conservative listeners out there who accuse him of being a socialist, I only propose this. It seems that the jobs like me, go back to Reagan, the service economy, jobs like mine are decreasing where I can afford to feed my family, have disposable income to support the small business, thusly keeping them in business. Those jobs have been leaving this country at a horrendous rate for the last 30 years. It's okay to send them over to China, last check, People's Republic of China is a communist country, and instead of raising taxes to pay as you go, fiscally responsible for the two wars we've had, we've also been content to be indebted to the People's Republic of China, again, a communist country. I see that we're only empowering them to become the next superpower, and what are we going to do, hand them a credit card and ask them if they want French fries with that? Pardon my anger, but we need to create American jobs. I see our president attempting desperately to do that. As far as the national health care issue, even Eisenhower tried to address it. Even Nixon tried to address it. Everybody forgets Clinton also tried to address it. Everybody wants to throw rocks at Obama. Myself, I think he's doing the best he can with what he's got. You cannot take a stand to the right or the left and expect to make advancements. He is trying to compromise and make the best of a very ugly situation.
Thank you, Glenn. Professor Jacobs.
Well, you know, I think Glenn puts the Obama brief well. you know, this is one of those eras, you can think back to FDR or Truman, when future historians are going to look back and say, wow, we were very close to the edge. And we may still topple over it. I mean, I think this economic situation and what's happening in terms of global financial markets is worrisome. And I think the president is the president of the country. He's got to try to bring people together, and that often means doing things that he would not want to do and which infuriate his supporters, which I guarantee you is not something he wants to be doing. Behind the scenes, we know there have been ferocious battles, for instance, between the president and Nancy Pelosi. This has now been written about pretty extensively, where Pelosi's really let him have it for compromises on health care reform and now on the tax cuts. So this is a difficult position, and frankly, I think any president in this position would be facing ire, whether a Democrat or Republican or a different Democrat.
Professor Jacobs, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Professor Lawrence Jacobs, professor and director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Peace for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with a very interesting conversation and get a chance to hear from Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. So stay with us here on the Ideas Network.